Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
An L.A. poet, musician, performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth and Agony out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Today, my guest is L.A. writer and fellow TNB contributor Lenore Zion. How are you, Lenore?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Speaking of TNB, The Nervous Breakdown, Lenore Zion's first book, My Dead Pets Are Interesting, was published by TNB Books in 2011. She's a contributor to The Nervous Breakdown, as I said before, which was started by Brad Listy in 2008. Lenore has a doctorate in clinical psychology, a degree which has spawned her interest in psychological abnormalities. Her specialty is the treatment of sexual pathologies, including exhibitionism, pedophilia, fetishism, sadism, masochism, among others. And if that weren't enough, Lenore's latest novel, Stupid Children, has been published by Emergency Press. Lenore, why don't you start off by telling us about your latest novel, Stupid Children, and Jane's Dilemma, as the book opens.
All right. Well, the book is about a girl who ends up being raised in a cult called the Second Day Believers because she's sent into foster care and they place her there. It's dark humor, so it's not taking itself too seriously, but, Jane essentially is given the full cult experience because of the placement in the family that she ends up with.
And, I read somewhere in an interview that Catherine Dunn's Geek Love, which was a book that I really loved, was one of your inspirations for writing this particular book. And I'm curious, how did her book inspire you?
Yeah, that's a good question. Geek Love, I also absolutely love that book. It was one of the first books that I can remember really, really falling in love with. And when I read it, I was so struck by the fact that all of the characters were these repulsive, kind of awful, awful people. They were doing immoral things. They were, physically deformed. Catherine Dunn made a whole roster of characters that were almost impossible to love based on, if you saw their credentials on paper, right? But you end up loving every single one of them. And she just didn't balk at the opportunity to be disgusting. And
no,
I loved
didn't.
That. Yeah, I just loved that in her book. And I think that it kind of freed me up to feel like I could be as disgusting as I wanted to be in my book, and that other people, if they love Catherine Dunn's book, then maybe they'll love what I write when it's disgusting. So,
yeah, I'd read somewhere, and this is going back a number of years, sometime after Catherine Dunn had written that novel, that David Lynch had optioned it, and I was so excited waiting to see, the pairing of Catherine Dunn and David Lynch, but I don't know whatever happened to that, because that's been some years now, but that would have been an amazing movie.
Now I have to mourn the fact that never happened. I didn't know until now. Thanks a lot, Rich.
Yeah, sorry, Lenore. The cultists, speaking of sick and for that matter, utterly believable. The cultists in your book, The Second Day Believers, are sick and twisted, and, as I said, utterly believable. That and how Jane describes the events that take place in the book, she has a very knowing voice, a social scientist, you know, sharp eyes, and then putting all these elements together, I'm wondering how much your PhD in clinical psychology helped you in achieving this goal when writing.
A lot. You know, I when I wrote the book, I intended to write it with a flawed voice, the kind of voice of a person who's actually been through the experiences that she's talking about, you know. So I wanted her to be fully equipped with, you know, the defenses that she would demonstrate and you know, the sense of humor, you know, intellectualizing and joking around about pain and this sort of thing. So I tried to make it as realistic as possible for a trauma survivor, for the voice to sound like an actual trauma survivor. And I think that, obviously, I don't think that I would have known what that voice sounded like if I weren't a psychologist. So.
Yeah, and actually that was something I was going to ask you about later on, you know, about that, about how there are times where she seems like she's somewhat emotionally detached from what she's talking about. She has mm-hmm. that sort of sharp, biting wit. And that was actually a question I had, if those are sorts of things that someone who had been through a situation like that, if those were the behaviors that they would exhibit. And obviously you said that that is indeed the case.
Well, for some of them, you know, every individual
right.
is different. But, you know, I think that with Jane, you know, if she were a real human being, I think that, you know, her intellectualizing and rationalizing and you know, making jokes about the traumas that she's subjected to, I think that those are her chosen defenses. And, you know, that's why it comes across that way. But, you know, not everybody will respond that way. It's just the way
yeah.
that my protagonist did.
Sure, sure. In regards to the Second Day Believers, did you use any sorts of materials in particular for your cult research?
No, you know, this is, I can't tell if I have shame about this or not, but I actually didn't really research it. I just created a cult in my head. You know, I thought this will be fun. You know, I get to make the cult believe whatever I want them to believe and do whatever I want to do. So I didn't particularly want to, I didn't really want to be mirroring anything that actually exists in real life or anything like that. But there's one detail that I have the Second Day Believers engage in behaviorally that I heard through the grapevine from a friend exists in real life. But, you know, I don't know if that's actually real or not. So I wouldn't
right.
say that counts as research.
Right. You know, for Jane, she has to, she had to become an adult and even a parent before her time. You know, she doesn't have a mother. Her father attempts suicide very early on in the book. What are your thoughts on children that have to prematurely act as adults or parents? How does that color their later lives?
Well, again, it depends on the individual. But I
yeah.
think for a lot of people, they're, you know, a lost childhood is going to make you angry at your parents for not having taken care of you the way that they should have. And it's going to make you defended and cause you to believe that you need to, that you are the only person who will ever be able to take care of yourself. So it's probably going to create some serious attachment problems and intimacy issues later in life.
Yeah. So when you were creating Jane, were there ever any moments where you were looking at her and saying, wow, you know, I really shared this quality with her or that quality with her?
Well, you know, it's funny. That's a funny question because I actually kind of think the book is an entire, like, metaphorical representation of my subconscious. And I actually think everybody's book is that. You know,
yeah,
I'm surprised when people don't identify with their own characters. But I, you know, I've certainly not experienced the same things that Jane has experienced. But, you know, the way that she feels in response to things, the way that she, you know, like her defenses are generally my defenses. And, you know, I'm very much a part of everything in that book. Just because it's fictional and just because these things didn't happen to me doesn't mean that they're not representative of something that did, you know. So
right.
It's a pretty personal book, even if it's fiction.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I got that. you her voice is very intimate. I mean, you seem very close to her because there's a very intimate feeling to it. So I totally get that. You know, I've met your family before in real life, and they all seem like loving, supportive folks. You know, your mom's also a writer at the Nervous Breakdown. She's a painter, you know, and I know that all families have their own neuroses, but, you know, looking from the outside in, your family doesn't seem to have nearly as many problems as poor Jane's family. And that said, I'm curious, what inspired you to create Jane's world as tragic as it was? And how were you able to sort of keep that through line going?
Well, you know, my family keeps me alive. They're the people to whom I am closest in life and the most supportive figures in my life. And without them, I just don't know where I would be. You know, I have no clue how life would look without them. And so I'm constantly inspired by the thought of what it would look like if somebody like me existed on her own, you know, in solitude. That's what it would look like if I lost my family. So I think I'm just sort of like, you know, masochistically imagining, you know, the death of my family through this book or something. I suppose that's the best way to describe it.
Sure. Do you have something, you know, I saw you one night at a TNB reading, Nervous Breakdown reading, reading a section from the book about when Jane gets a tattoo, and it was, heard in and of itself, I thought one of my first thoughts was like, wow, this would be an amazing monologue or spoken word piece. It was just so well written, and it was also then interesting to go and see it within the context of the novel, because, you know, you have the narrative going along, and then there's the one section where it just sort of breaks away from the narrative for a moment, to some degree, and then it just immerses, you know, Jane sort of immerses herself into this whole world of talking about this tattoo and everything, and then you sort of slip back out and, you know, sort of back into the narrative flow. But I really thought, I mean, stylistically, I thought that was a very cool thing. In and of itself, it's a great piece, but I also thought, set within the context of the novel, it was a really wonderful thing you did.
I'm glad you liked that. You know, my publisher, Brian Tomasevich, and I, we talked about these pieces. We called them the asides. I think there's like three or four throughout the book where I just stop with the story and have her, you know, I think those are either love them or hate them stylistic mm-hmm. choices. And I love them. And I think that I probably love them, you know, just as a psychologist even, because I think that a lot of times when things get too intense emotionally, when things are moving in a pace that's uncomfortable for a client, you know, that they might need to stop and focus on something that's not necessarily their story for a minute and just kind of talk about a phenomenon or something, you know, something like this. And so I kind of saw these asides as Jane warming up to talk about the thing that was really meaningful, you know, the scene that's following it that's really meaningful to her, and she needed to warm up for it.
Yes.
By giving a psychological background of what she's about to talk about, you know?
Yep. And it was beautiful because kind of like what you said, you know, you witness people doing that in real life, and it's just really beautiful how it played out in the book. So, yeah, I would love for you to share that.
Okay. Wait, hearing that?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. The first time you get tattooed, it feels as though you're changing absolutely everything. Nothing will ever be the same, you think, as the needle is dragged across your skin. And then you start to think about what a gigantic mistake you're making, about how nothing will ever be the same in a bad way now that you've defiled yourself permanently. What you want to do is yell at the bald man, who happens to have a tattoo of something unidentifiable on his skull, to stop immediately. But you don't want to be a bother. You don't want to be one of those indecisive people who goes into a tattoo shop and almost gets a tattoo, thus wasting the artist's time, so you don't say anything in the first moments while the tattoo is only just thought. Instead, you sit quietly watching the ball zan pass through you, and each second that passes by, you literally watch your mistake grow larger and thicker and darker until it becomes official. You cannot yell at the bald man to stop any longer because it makes no sense for him to stop at that point. After all, a completed tattoo is preferred to an incomplete tattoo, though if you had only yelled out right when he began, you could have gotten away with just a small black dot on your skin. A small black dot could easily go undetected. The tattoo at this point is beginning to take shape, which allows you to more comprehensively understand that you've walked into a place of business and, for reasons you can no longer recall, requested that one of its employees permanently stamp the image of a butterfly or a fairy or a shooting star onto your flesh. The bald man with a tattoo on his skull switches needles and begins to apply color to the outline of a butterfly or a fairy or a shooting star that is now indelibly present on your upper left arm. And you think, Jesus Christ, what have I done? But thinking this helps you in no way, and the sharp turquoise you've selected is looking more and more absurd every time the tattoo artist wipes away the excess ink from your raw skin, and you begin to wonder what led you to believe you might want a butterfly or a fairy or a shooting star tattooed on your arm, as you don't have any particularly strong feelings in regards to any of these things. You may as well have requested an image of a dolphin leaping from waves, because at least a turquoise would make sense in the context of an ocean theme. There is no truth to the image you've selected, and in tattooing it on your arm, you've, for all intents and purposes, turned yourself into the very definition of a phony. And then the tattoo is complete, and your ears are ringing, and all that you can see is your larger-than-expected blunder, an error not soon to be forgotten because the error itself is visible and will serve as a reminder forever and ever and all of eternity. You spend hours in front of the mirror in the bathroom of the apartment you've been living in, and there's dirt in the grout between the tiles and the fluorescent lights buzz and flicker on and off, and you wish the light would just burn out already so that the dark could shield you from your big, stupid turquoise mistake. But those fucking lights never burn out. They just keep flickering forever, and you know they'll never die, just like this tattoo of a butterfly or a fairy or a shooting star, and simply put, you're trapped. Months go by, time passes, and you achieve a sense of acceptance about your stupid turquoise tattoo. Hey, it's there. There's nothing I can do about it now, you think. Or is there? Perhaps if you get another tattoo, one a bit less ridiculous, you won't be the person with the imbecilic turquoise tattoo of a butterfly or a fairy or a shooting star. You'll be the person with a cool tattoo and also a starter tattoo. And the starter tattoo can serve as a jumping-off point for self-deprecation, which most people find so charming, so long as you don't veer too close to the border of uncomfortable truth. All is not lost, and you molt the layer of acceptance and find this glorious hope beneath it. And before you know it, you're back in the exact same chair, watching a needle mark you forever with a new design. And you're shocked to realize that your reaction to this new, well-thought-out, much cooler design is in every respect identical to what you experienced the first time you were in this position. Fuck, you think. The cycle continues to repeat itself, and before you know it, you've got several tattoos, and you keep telling yourself that it doesn't matter, it's only flesh, you're a finite being, and one day this flesh you've stained with turquoise absurdity will rot and disappear, and you will be left a pile of bones or ashes, depending on how you'd like your corpse treated once you've departed this earth, and none of it will matter. But before that happens, sometime between now and then, you realize that actually, these tattoos you've gotten are perfect. After all, isn't life just one big joke? Yes, you realize, it is, and you've turned yourself into a cartoon strip, and nothing, nothing could more accurately reflect the truth of life than that.
Well done, Lenore. Thank you. You know, if you're just tuning in, my guest is Lenore Zion, author most recently of the novel Stupid Children, published by Emergency Press. You know, Lenore, you were talking about these asides earlier and working with your editor. You know, I read somewhere that you wrote, well, that Stupid Children, I guess, maybe originally started out as something called Victimology, but then it morphed into Stupid Children, and once you had realized that, you had a draft of the novel done within 2 months. Is that correct?
It is. But, you know, I mean, the book is short. You know, it's not like I wrote War and Peace here. It's a short book. And I had like a weird dissociative experience writing this book. A lot of the book I just simply don't remember writing. So I don't know. I think I was possessed or something.
Right. Was it Because it, am I correct in saying that it did originally start out as a piece of work called Victimology?
Yeah, it did, and that book was terrible, and I trashed it.
Was there, you just spoke about how there were moments where you just sort of felt you were outside of yourself and you weren't even, you weren't aware of writing certain passages or whatever. Was there a clear point where you said, okay, this Victimology is a piece of crap, I need to change gears here? Did that have a clear beginning and end point going into Stupid Children?
Well, I worked for, I think, like a year and a half or 2 years or something like that, toiling away at this thing that I was calling Victimology. And it was sort of like slapstick comedy. I mean, the premise was, that I had the same protagonist, Jane, but she was the daughter of a conservative talk radio host, and then special interest groups were, taking turns kidnapping her in order to influence what he said on air, And
right.
So there's this sort of like kidnappy, element, but, the same sort of like passive protagonist who's just having things happen to her, But it, for some reason, I guess I was just so self-aware writing it, and it like I said, it was sort of slapsticky, which is something I don't even find funny or interesting, So
right.
I worked for a long time on this before I realized that it was as if I was writing somebody else's book, it just didn't feel right. And so I eventually got frustrated enough that I just threw it out. I got rid of it, except for about, maybe cumulative 20 pages, which does appear in this book. And then I was working at the time, and when clients would cancel, I would take my laptop and just start writing something, anything. And I wasn't trying to write a novel. And I had these 2 hours where I had canceled clients, and I wrote two separate pieces, and thought all of a sudden when I saw them together, oh man, I'm writing my book. This is what it is. And all of a sudden it just seemed like really obvious and easy. And, obviously I just have to write like this and use this voice and touch on these topics and so on and so forth. The irony, of course, is that what I wrote there that made me realize that it was my book, those pieces ended up being cut from the book. one of the edits that Brian made that was actually a genius edit when I look back at it now. But
Well, speaking of Brian, because this was something else I wanted to talk about, because I'm very curious about this process. So you finish writing, you get a draft of Stupid Children together. How did it get in the hands of Emergency Press?
My agent submitted it to them.
Okay.
And I think that's how it got to Brian. I'm not sure, but obviously I know Gina and Tom Hansen, and they've both been Gina Frangello, and they've both been published by Emergency Press. So I'd heard really great things. Oh, and Aaron Dietz too. I've heard really great things about Brian before I ever worked with him. And so I was kind of crossing my fingers that, that he would be interested in my book, and, I got lucky and he was. So
the version of Stupid Children that you handed in versus the version of Stupid Children, that I have in my hands as a reader, did it go through a lot of changes from point A to B?
No. The biggest edit and really the only one that's noticeable is that he chopped off the first 30 pages, which I at first was really, I was really attached to those 30 pages that he chopped off, but they really did need to go. I mean, I look at them now and I'm appalled that I even let him read them,
right.
Any of the people that my agent submitted the book to. I don't blame them for passing, the people who passed, because the first 30 pages were just, they didn't belong there. It was,
right.
I have no idea why I didn't see it before, but.
Yeah, well, sometimes it just takes, whether it's writing or whatever, someone just takes other people pointing these things out to us, but
yeah.
But good for
another
you.
Another set of eyes.
Yep. Yeah, curious, taking from the title, Stupid Children, what are some things that Jane can consider stupid, would you say, in children or anyone for that matter?
I think that Jane thinks it's stupid when she can't emotionally conquer trauma that she's not out of yet. She wants to be able to completely divorce herself of her emotional response to the terrible things happening in her life, and she finds it really stupid that she can't, and she finds it really stupid when other people don't see things that she sees as obvious. So she's kind of always looking at everyone going, what the hell is the matter with you? You know, how do you not, why are you guys acting this way? Look, it's obvious. Stop behaving this way. This is the way you need to behave instead. And so she's a little bit, she's a little bit concrete and doesn't realize that not everybody processes things in exactly the same way that she does.
Yeah. You know, sort of piggybacking that idea, I love how Jane says that her experience with the Second Day Believers is only a more extreme version of the shit we all go through in life. And I'm curious, with your perspective as a therapist, how does this day-to-day barrage of all the shit we go through in life profoundly affect some people, and yet some others are able to just kind of get by and be cool and whatever? I guess what I'm asking is, what are some coping skills? You as a therapist, what are coping skills that people can develop, you know, to not be one of those stupid children, so to say, in life?
Well, I think two things that are very different are the most important two things for general mental health. One is some form of exercise, you know, whether it's yoga or Pilates or running or anything, something like that, that keeps you feeling physically taken care of, because your body is very, very much a part of your emotional health too. And so that's a really important thing. But even more important than that, I think, is aiming for actual true intimacy in the relationships that you have in your life. And by intimacy, I don't mean to imply anything sexual, but just sort of the ability to be completely honest with oneself and with another without fear of consequence. So the less alone you feel in life and the more truly known and understood you feel, the better you're going in life. People are social creatures, you know, not a one of us is a lone wolf. And if we don't truly invite people into our lives, then we can't really feel embraced by others. We can only feel sort of superficially embraced, and that's not going to cut it. So I think really working on emotional honesty and intimacy is so important for any person, whether they've been through any kind of serious trauma or not. I think that's, you know, it's a huge element of good mental health.
Yeah, yeah. Very well said, by the way. So you've got, you know, your other collection. Well, no, actually, I want to ask this other question first. You know, I've read some really good reviews for your book, and I'm curious, overall, how have the reviews been for the book?
You know, I think that this book is maybe, like I said about the asides, I think it's a love it or hate it book. You know, I haven't had too many, you know, middle of the road reviews. People either seem to really, really connect with it and find it fantastic and great in every way, or they just absolutely hate it. And it's kind of funny, like, you know, I was talking about this book is very, very personal to me, and I think that pretty much everybody's book, you know, anybody who's written a book, it's a very personal experience. But I think, you know, throughout my life, people have responded to me as a human being in exactly the same way. You know, people either seem to really like me and connect with me, or they just simply don't get me. And so I'm not really surprised that that's the response to my book.
Right.
You know,
I get you, Lenore. And I love you.
I know.
That's why you're on the show.
The feeling is mutual.
Do you get too attached to reviews, either good or bad? I mean, how has that process been for you?
Gosh, well, I mean, I'm certainly aware of every time somebody is, like, reading my book on Goodreads. You know, I'm very aware of that. I'm not one of those people who doesn't read my reviews. I can't help myself. So, you know, I try not to let any good review feel like gospel to me, because I know right around the corner there's going to be somebody saying the opposite, you know, and I don't want to feel like that's gospel either. So, you know, I of course, just like I think any other human being, if I read a bad review, and, you know, sometimes with bad reviews people will get kind of personal and sort of attack you as a writer, and you as a person, not as a writer, you know. And those I might perseverate on a little bit longer than, you know, just the one that's saying this isn't my kind of writing or whatever. But, it's certainly not making or breaking my day. It's not ruining my life or making it better, you know.
Sure. To briefly touch upon your first book, your collection of stories, My Dead Pets Are Interesting, which was published by TNB Books, TNB, The Nervous Breakdown, Brad Listy. We love Brad Listy. How did that come about?
The collection, how did that come about?
How did the stories come about? And then, how did it come about that it became published eventually?
Brad started his imprint, and then I've known Brad since grad school. I guess that he just felt like it would be a good idea to publish a collection of my humor essays. So we took a bunch of things that I had written for TNB, and then I wrote, you know, a bunch more, and we went ahead and put them together and created a book out of them and released it. And, you know. That book seems to be far more palatable to a wider audience, which is interesting to me because, with these two books, I would have thought that Stupid Children would have been more universally embraced, and Dead Pets would have been kind of like, Jesus, this person is really bizarre, you know?
Right. You know, I've seen some pictures that you've posted before of dead, speaking of dead pets and everything, I've seen some pictures you've posted before of dead birds.
Right, my dead birds.
yes, and I was wondering if you could talk a little about your connection, your fascination with that.
Yeah, of course. You know, I'm a lone twin, and by that I mean I was supposed to be an identical twin, and my twin sister died in the womb. And so the fact that she died before she was born is a very confusing thing to me when I was growing up. I'm bad at estimating age, but whenever you're in preschool or kindergarten or whatever that is, I guess that's seven, maybe, I don't know. My mother dropped me off for school on what was actually a holiday, and I came across this little fetal bird hanging out of a shell that had fallen from a tree, and it's all of a sudden completely clicked with me what it meant to have died before you were born, you know.
Wow.
And so it was this very profound experience that I had when I was very, very young, and helped me to understand something that, you know, affected and continues to affect me on a daily basis. And so dead birds to me are sort of representative of my twin sister, and there's just a sentimental attachment to them. And
sure.
Oddly, I guess sharing this with people, I talked about this in Dead Pets. This was, I think, the last essay that's in the book. I talk about this. And people send me pictures of dead pets, people I've never, or not of dead pets, of dead birds, people that I've never met. And it makes me feel, like, really connected to people, you know, in other countries and stuff. It's like a really weird phenomenon that's occurred because of the story, and I just love it.
Wow, that's
I have like a vast
actually quite beautiful
of dead bird pictures. Yeah.
Wow. Not to jinx anything or anything like that, but do you care to talk about anything you're working on currently?
Yes. I mean, I'll talk a little bit about it. I'm working
Great.
On two different television pilots, and you know, that's. I really don't know how those kinds of things end up working out in the end, but I'm hoping for the best. And then I'm working on my new novel, and the novel is still too early to really talk about in terms of theme or plot or anything like that. But I'm certainly writing from a psychological end again. So
right.
There's that. for people who
have you ever tried your hand at a, speaking of television, have you ever tried writing a screenplay, or for that matter, any thoughts of trying to adapt Stupid Children into a screenplay form, or has anyone approached you about that or anything?
I have written screenplay before, but it's not really my favorite medium. I far prefer writing TV if I'm writing, in that medium. And I've, a lot of people have mentioned that, Stupid Children seems like something that would be really well adapted to film. And, I'm certainly open to it. I am not personally trying to adapt it into a screenplay, but I'm certainly open to the possibility of that happening.
Right, right. So we're getting close to the end of our time. Lenore, where can people find you online?
Facebook, Twitter. Mm-hmm. I have a website, but I don't really know. It's LenoreZion.com. It doesn't really say anything there other than that I have books, and we've just been talking about that. So, Facebook and Twitter. I'm pretty active on Facebook and semi-active on Twitter. But I absolutely love new Facebook friends, especially if they're going to send me pictures of dead birds.
You hear that, people? Send Lenore Zion pictures of dead birds. And Lenore, if I see a dead bird in my travels, I will be sure to take a picture of it and send it to you as well.
I certainly hope so.
With me today, again, has been Lenore Zion, author most recently of the novel Stupid Children, published by Emergency Press. Lenore, thanks again for being on the show.
Oh, thanks. It was great to talk to you, Rich.
Yeah, and likewise. And I want to send a big thank you out to our show's sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julie at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. The show's theme music is by We Voice Sing, speaking of which you can find me online at wevoicesing.com. And We Voice Sing has just released our debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire, which can be found at wevoicesing.com. You can also find me, Rich Ferguson, on YouTube, Facebook. Tune in next time when my guest will be the amazing singer-songwriter Jeanette Napolitano, formerly of the band Concrete Blonde, but now performing as the lovely Jeanette Napolitano. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.